Welcome to The Creative Way on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Vanessa Finney. Most of us have had the experience of sitting in a theater and being dazzled by a live performance, but we don't always see the sweat and tears behind the making of it. My guest today has written a book to show us that process and all its fits and starts and humbling setbacks on the path to glory. Daniel Pollack Pelsner teaches English and theater at Portland State University. He's the author of a new book about a towering figure in the world of musical theater. It's called Lin-Manuel Miranda, The Education of an Artist. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Vanessa.
I was wondering, with all the angles you can look at an artist's work from, what made you take the angle of education?
Oh, well, so I'm a teacher myself. I've got so many students who want to live creative lives, enter the world of the arts, and are trying to figure out how to do it because it's not the kind of clear path like, you know, going to law school or med school. And as an arts journalist, I'd interviewed Lin-Manuel Miranda several times over the last decade. And whenever I talked to him, he would always talk about the teachers who had helped him develop as an artist. And he'd talk about taking on new projects based on what he could learn from the people that he'd be collaborating from. And so I thought, telling his story based on what he learned from mentors and collaborators and figures who are important to him from childhood all the way through Stephen Sondheim and Andrew Lloyd Webber might be, you know, not a blueprint, but a kind of mindset that my own students could use if they wanted to figure out how to synthesize their heritage and their influences and their passions into something new the way that Lin-Manuel did.
Have you had a chance to share this book with your students yet?
I've just started doing some student events, and I'm getting back into the PSU classroom where I helped to develop this this work. And so I'm so excited to be able to discuss it. And actually, I had a few of my students who were early readers for the book, and they told me a bit about which parts particularly resonated with them. And now at the end of my classes at Portland State, students have the chance if they want to create their own musicals. And I love hearing what they come up with.
So you do bring to life so well that part of a creative student's experience at where Lin-Manuel went, at Hunter University in Wesleyan. I'm curious if you know what their reactions have been among either individual teachers or the institutions.
You know, I was so touched that Lin-Manuel's elementary school music teacher, Barbara Ames, who was directed the sixth grade play at Hunter College Elementary and cast Lin-Manuel in his first starring roles, she came to my book launch in New York City, even though she's now retired and it's difficult for her to get out of the house. And I think she's felt so moved that Lin-Manuel has credited her throughout his career with giving him that opportunity to shine for the first time. And so I love that she's felt honored by his legacy and that I could include a little part of it.
So let's get into some of the themes of your book. First of all, there's this idea that I loved. It's so worthwhile making a book just for this purpose, I think, especially for the students that you mentioned. There's this idea that you should create from wherever you are as an artist. Don't wait for perfection to release something into the world. Let it be messy so you can grow.
I'm so glad, Vanessa, that you're drawing out that theme, because that was one of the things that really stuck with me looking at Lin-Manuel, especially as a young artist. I think for a lot of the world, he just kind of burst onto the scene with Hamilton in 2015, but that was actually the eighth musical that he had written going back to high school and college. And he was a guy who told me who just wasn't concerned by what so many of his classmates felt really inhibited by, which was the gap between the art that you love and what you can make when you first start out trying a craft. And he didn't worry that the first things he wrote weren't going to sound as good as Rent or Sweeney Todd or Phantom of the Opera. He just trusted that through the process of making them, he'd get better. And by collaborating with other students who had skills that he didn't have, he'd be able to expand the quality of the work that he was trying to pursue. And so I think by kids' school, they call it a growth mindset. It's not just you're good at this or you're bad at this. It's that you can learn how to do things through the process of making them. And I love that he opened up his old Dropbox folder for me to be able to see the first drafts of all of his work. And that actually helped me as a writer, too, to know that works of art I admire don't come out perfect the first time. Those masterpieces are the result of lots of trial and error, lots of feedback, and lots of false starts along the way.
This might be a good time to ask you to read a passage. Do you have a selection from your book?
Sure. Yeah. Just thinking about what you mentioned, Vanessa, of just getting started making things. I thought about the first things that Lin-Manuel tried to make as a kid, which were actually movies. So here's a little passage about his childhood creative passions. His father had brought home an early VHS camcorder from the mayor's office when Lin-Manuel was 7, and since then he'd been obsessed with making movies. He graduated from stop-motion animation with Coke bottles and G.I. Joes to live-action remakes of his favorite film sequences. He even coaxed his Abuela Mundi onto the floor to reenact the 1989 medical alarm commercial. "I've fallen and I can't get up." He carried his family's 2 VCRs into his bedroom, hooked them up to his TV, and spent hours with his finger hovering over the record and pause buttons, editing his footage. He wasn't allowed to tote the camcorder to Puerto Rico for the month he stayed with his grandparents every summer, so his abuelo Guisin borrowed a security camera from the credit union where he worked. The family ran a video store, and Lin-Manuel could watch whatever he wanted, fueled by a mix of Looney Tunes and 80s action comedies. He told his grandfather where to point the camera as he staged ever more elaborate and gruesome sequences, putting some newly acquired blood capsules to work. The camera's audio dubbing feature allowed him to film a fight scene and juice up the slapping and punching sounds afterward. A later model with video dubbing let him record a song and then superimpose his own images, a gateway to music videos and lushly scored death scenes. He was experimenting, charting his own self-directed film school course. He wasn't daunted by the limitations of being a young artist. "It was so much more interesting for me to make stuff than to think about making stuff," he says. "You couldn't exactly make a movie like you saw in the movies, but with a video camera, you could get pretty close."
And as a quick reminder, I'm talking with Portland-based teacher and theater critic Daniel Pollack Pilsner about his new book, Lin-Manuel Miranda, The Education of an Artist. You're listening to The Creative Way on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Vanessa Finney. So since you chose that passage, and it reminds us that he was originally going to be a filmmaker, but a lot of us came to know him as the youngest Tony Award winner ever for his Broadway show, In the Heights. So tell us briefly about what drew him into that other art form.
You know what it was? It was his high school girlfriend Meredith taking him to see the musical Rent for his 17th birthday. 1996, Rent was the Hamilton of the 90s on Broadway, and it was the first show that Lin-Manuel had seen that sounded like the music he listened to and that looked like the world that he saw on the A train in New York. And that made him feel like musicals didn't have to be about cats or phantoms or the French Revolution. They could actually be about what he was most excited about and what he was most scared about. And that led him to write his first musical as a junior in high school called Nightmare in D Major, about the ghost of a fetal pig that comes back to seek revenge on the kid who dissected him for AP bio class.
Oh, that old plot.
Exactly.
What you just touched on is something that excited you relate in the book that something that excited him and was really a revelation is how you could tell a story on Broadway through pop music. You know, a lot of times, if we know people know jazz standards, it goes the reverse way. You know, you have the score that's written for a theater piece, and then it filters into pop culture. But he was saying, no, I can tell the story of my people and other groups through existing music and be inspired by this. Talk about that and how he was so culturally voracious. So all these different genres just fed into these stories.
Oh, you're totally right. I think of him as a cultural omnivore, just eating out of every station on the buffet. And he grew up with his parents listening to Puerto Rican protest music, and his mom was a big Broadway fan who would play cast albums. He had an elementary school bus driver who was a rising hip hop artist from the Bronx and would rap to him on his drive to Hunter College Elementary School. He traded mixtapes with his friends, and he was a 90s kid, so he was listening to grunge, he was listening to indie rock, he was listening to pop, and it was right around the time that hip hop was coming mainstream as well. So he says his first musicals were basically imitation Jonathan Larson, sort of guitar, bass, drum sounds. But then when he was a sophomore in college at Wesleyan, he lived in a Latino cultural house called La Casa, where he was for the first time surrounded by other kids who, like him, were the children of immigrants who were code switching between mostly Spanish-speaking households and majority white educational environments. And that was, he says, what gave him the courage to start writing music out of everything that he loved. And he wrote a very, very first draft of his first full-length musical In the Heights when he was a sophomore in college, drawing on Latin music, on bachata, on merengue, on salsa, and on hip-hop as well, to try to represent the community that he grew up in.
And yet he did that so successfully, but he also had to learn the lesson along the way, and he was still very young when he learned it, that he needed collaborators.
You're
So,
absolutely right.
yeah, so he had this genius for writing melody and lyric, but he couldn't quite bring it to life to orchestrate it. So that was one of the holes he needed to fill with his collaborators, right?
He was not a great piano player. He sort of dropped out of piano lessons. He didn't like playing what was prescribed for him. He wanted to make up his own stuff. So he had these ideas in his head, but his fingers couldn't bring them to life on the keyboard. And it got to the point where early producers of his work asked if he needed a different composer to start writing his tunes. But he's always been a guy who really values the talents of the people around him. Back into elementary school and high school, where he'd recruit better instrumentalists and better singers to help realize his work. And so he was thrilled when some of the early actors on In the Heights introduced him to a brilliant pianist and arranger named Alex Lacamoire, who grew up in a Cuban family in Miami and LA, and could just intuit what was in Lin-Manuel's head and then bring it to beautiful life on the keyboard. And once Lin-Manuel started working with Alex and another arranger from Wesley and Bill Sherman, brought in a new playwright to write the script for In the Heights, named Chiara Alegría Huidiz, who also had access to wonderful Latino stories, and a director named Tommy Cale, who helped him figure out how an audience could relate to the material. They formed what Lin-Manuel called Voltron. He's an 80s TV kid, and he remembered the show about the super robot that comes together from all the individual robots. And that was what he named their group, Voltron, a super robot that could do what no individual robot could do on its own.
I love that image. Just the idea of such a cohesive team working on the same goal. Now, and all of this, by the way, is before we even get to Hamilton and all the Disney in the book. You know, there's just so much in the first part of the book. But the stories in this take us behind the scenes of theater production and music composition. So it touches on a lot of artistries. Can you take us behind the scenes of your own research and writing? You know, you're a critic and you've interviewed lots of different artists. Why this particular story, and what was Lin-Manuel's reaction when you ran it by him?
Yes, so I'm a Shakespeare professor by training, and I actually think of this whole book, Vanessa, as a love letter to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. I grew up in Oregon, going to OSF in Ashland every summer with my family. And when I moved back to Oregon to become a professor, I would take student groups and alumni groups down every summer. And I started getting into thinking about who our Shakespeares might be today, who are telling the big national scale stories in new aesthetic forms that help expand our sense of who we are as a country. And OSF had an amazing project to commission new playwrights to write about moments of change in American history. And they put me in touch with some of these playwrights when I was writing about them for The New Yorker. And after a decade of my career having imaginary conversations with Shakespeare, who never returned my phone calls, I was thrilled to get a taste of your job of actually interviewing people who would talk to me about their artistic processes. And a director in New York said, if you wanted to think about modern day Shakespeare's, take a look at this guy in 2015 who'd just written a hip hop musical about the origins of the American Revolution. And I went to see Hamilton on Broadway. I was thrilled, like everybody was. There was actually a Shakespeare quote in the show. Hamilton quotes a line from Macbeth, and I thought, oh God, this is indeed our Shakespeare today. And a playwright whom I had gotten to know through the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Chiara Alegría Huidiz, who was the scriptwriter for In the Heights, introduced me to Lin-Manuel. I sent him an idea for this book, focusing on his teachers and his collaborators, and he told me that Stephen Sondheim, one of his most important mentors, had passed away. And so he was really thinking about how to honor the people who had helped him develop as an artist. And so that was an angle that he said really appealed to him. And we met up in New York, and he and I started brainstorming a list of his teachers, really beginning with his mother, a child psychologist whom he says gave him permission to feel deeply and a mantra. It's all grist for the mill that could help him turn his emotions into art. And that list kept growing. So I interviewed about 150 people for this book over the next couple of years, and then had the pleasure of trying to synthesize everything I'd learned into a story that would carry people along and not get them bogged down in every name and date. But I sort of thought of this as a coming of age novel that happened to be true. And it's been a treat to get to share it then with people who might resonate with this story.
You've been listening to The Creative Way on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Vanessa Finney. My guest was Daniel Pollack Pelsner, author of the new book, Lin-Manuel Miranda, The Education of an Artist.